Acts chapter 27, if you'd stand with me, we're going to read verses 1 through 13 together this morning. We'll be covering verses 1 through 26. We're going to take about roughly, well, not quite half the chapter, but we're only going to read the first 13 verses this morning. Acts 27, starting in verse 1. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, they proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in an Andromedan ship, which was about to sail to the regions along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. From there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. When we had sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There, the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us aboard. When we had sailed slowly for a good many days and with difficulty had arrived off Cnidus, since the wind did not permit us to go farther, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salome. And with difficulty sailing past it, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lacia. When we had considerable time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous since the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them and said to them, "Men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be with damage and great loss, and not only of the cargo and the ship, but also our lives." But the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than by what was being said by Paul. Because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, and the majority reached a decision to put out to sea from there, if somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete facing southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there, when the moderate south wind came up, supposing that they had attained their purpose, they weighed anchor and began sailing along Crete, close inshore. Thank you. You may be seated. I don't know if you are aware of it or not. There are a few things in life that are on television that I actually look forward to. One of those is Shark Week. I actually put that on my calendar every year. Yes, I'm a nerd. Since I was a child, I've always been infatuated with sharks, which when you live in the Midwest is probably not that great of an infatuation, okay? I was, informed early in life by Dad that, an oceanographer you won't be. Because, you live in Kansas, and there's not a whole lot of oceans nearby. But I bought every book I could, and I always read on sharks, and you can ask my kids every year, man, once Shark Week starts, it's just, I can't watch enough of that. Even last night, I was going down the guide going, okay, what's on and at what time, and what can I see of this week covering sharks? And I thought, what better way to commemorate Shark Week than leaving the courtroom and actually going out on the open seas with the Apostle Paul. I thought this was very fortuitous that we come to Acts chapter 27. I'd like to say I planned it that way, but I'm not that good. So this week, we're covering the shipwreck of the Apostle Paul. And as we cover this 27th chapter, this is really a very exciting verse. This scripture in Acts 27 is considered a very vivid account of Luke, who was actually there on the ship when these events were happening. This is maybe, perhaps, one of the more graphic writings in all the Bible. It is very vivid. It is also a rich tale that archaeologists have studied because of they look back to see, okay, the ancient art of seamanship, how was it done? We see tales of navigation. We see the very specific tales of sailing. And this is going to be hard for us to wrap our minds around at times because, again, we are Midwesterners, right? And probably not a lot of you here do a lot of sailing. I'm just going to guess. Now, one of you here will probably say, no, you're wrong. I sail somewhere or do something. But for most of us, these things are not going to be familiar terms. But these have been studied time and time again by historians. And they can't get over the richness of this text when it comes to how specific the details are of what takes place at sea. And we get to see really how people conduct themselves in difficult situations and times of crisis, and it's very valuable from that standpoint. But what I found most valuable as I read through the text was the fact that we see very clearly once again the providence of God. We see very clearly God's hand upon the life of Paul. We see once again God fulfilling promises made to Paul that you will go to Rome. You will be my witness. Just as you have here in Jerusalem, you will also go to Rome and you will be my witness in that place. So we see God's providence very clearly. If you have a bulletin this morning, you'll see that there are 4 points there. I tried to make them as close to what we would call maybe sailing points as I could. So you'll see the first point there is all aboard. If you've ever seen a ship take off from a port city, what is the call that goes out? It's what? All aboard, right? Maybe I should make you guys stand up and say all aboard. No, I won't do that. Okay. The second one is all change. Then it's apparently all over. But lastly, we're told that everything's going to be all right. So those are your 4 points. We're going to begin this morning with this call of all aboard, starting in verse 1 of chapter 27. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, they proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking on a Dramaten ship, which was about to sail in the regions along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea, accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. So one way or the other, Festus, the now Roman governor, and Agrippa found a way to send Paul off to Caesarea. It's now time to get on a ship. It's time to sail off to Italy. We see this in verses 1 and 2. We also see a word used by Luke, the writer of Acts. He says, we would sail for Italy. So once again, we see that Luke is part of the party. If you go down further, he says, along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea. And then he tells us we are accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. Now, if you think back, we've been introduced to Aristarchus back in Acts chapter 19. If you remember one of the many riots that Paul was swept up in, Aristarchus, unfortunately, was at the wrong place in the wrong time. He was with Paul back in Ephesus, and he was swept up in that riot. We also know that Aristarchus returned with Paul back to Jerusalem when he brought the offering from the saints in Macedonia back to the church in Jerusalem. You will also find Aristarchus's name in the book of Colossians and the book of Philemon. And if most historians are correct, those books both being written by Paul during his imprisonment, most people believe that Aristarchus was ultimately imprisoned along with Paul there in Rome. Not only that, other historians point to the fact that Aristarchus was also died a martyr's death at the hands of Nero. So Aristarchus is a good brother. He's close by. He's near him during this time. And when I read this, I see the very importance of having a Christian friend or more than one Christian friend. And this is something that we shouldn't take lightly as believers in Jesus Christ. I believe that it's important that we have friends that are believers. Now, please don't hear what I'm not saying. I didn't say the only friends in life that you can have is believers. Did I say that? No? Okay, good. But it is also important that we surround ourselves with friends that are believers. Right? Especially for our young people. If you are striving to walk with the Lord Jesus Christ, if your goal in life is to serve Him and glorify Him and honor Him with your life, there is no better way to do that than surrounding yourself by other people that are also striving to live for Jesus Christ. It would make sense. But not only that, it is good to have other believers around us to do life with and do fellowship with, to practice eternity with, because whether we like each other or not, we're going to spend a lot of time with one another. You know, part of this process of coming together each week on Sunday is to do corporate worship with our family, with other believers, and surrounding ourselves with Christian friends who we can share our victories with, our defeats with, and who can walk through those things with us. Why we do it. And you see the importance here is Aristarchus comes along with Paul. And this is important because Aristarchus isn't on a Disney cruise ship. There weren't people probably lining up next to Paul saying, oh, can I go too? Can I go to, I mean, we think Italy, right? Who doesn't want to go to Italy? Rome. So Some of you are saying, I'm not flying, so not me. But if you could just transport yourself there, right, you would go. So we understand that Rome, yes, it may sound good, but they're not going there for rest and relaxation. Paul is going to stand before Caesar. He is going, presumably, in chains. He may not be chained. They may not see him as a flight risk, obviously, on a ship. We're told that there are other prisoners traveling with Paul, so we understand that not only is Paul going, but I'm guessing that any of the prisoners that were kept in Caesarea are also on board traveling on this ship with Paul. We're told that there is an Augustan cohort there, and the leader of this cohort is named Julius. Julius is in charge of the ship. If he's the one who's in charge of the prisoners on board, he is the one who really has the say-so over all of these people on the board as far as the prisoners go. Now, I meant to put a map up here for you, and I really should have done this, but what you will see is on this journey is they're really sailing just right up against the coast everywhere they go. They're not going way out to sea, but because of the time of year that they're sailing, they're hugging the coastline, and they're traveling, going port to port, trying to make their way back to Rome. When we come to verse 3, it says that the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. Now, there's two things here that I want you to notice. The first thing is this. How does Julius, this Roman commander, the centurion, treat Paul? He shows consideration. It means he was kind to Paul. It means that he trusted Paul. He trusted Paul enough to say, you know what? While we're here in Sidon, you can go see your friends. That shows a lot of respect for Paul. Remember, understanding the Roman system of justice, if that cohort, if that Roman leader was to lose Paul, what would happen? That could be his own life. So he doesn't send Paul away not trusting Paul. And I can tell you something from the study of the Scriptures. One thing you find out very quickly, the Romans weren't the best at picking governors. Most of them were evil. Most of them were not good men. And most of them, it was a very political decision, but most of the centurions you see, as we study through Acts, are what? Generally, more kind, more willing to listen, more willing to actually help out. Think how Paul's been helped out by these different Roman centurions along the way, or the Roman tribunes along the way. If you think back to when he was first put in custody, he asked the Roman tribune, "Can I go speak to the crowd?" And what did he say? "Sure, Paul, go speak to the crowd." So we see this along the way as we travel. That's the first thing I want you to notice. The second thing I want you to notice here is where they're at. They're in Sidon, and apparently there's a church here in Sidon, and Paul gets to go see his friends. And as I read that, I thought back to Jesus' words in John 15:15, where he says, "No longer will I call you slaves, but I will now call you what? Friends." And Paul is among friends. Apparently there's a church of some sort there. And most people believe the church at Sidon would have began by the persecution of Saul of Tarsus all the way back in Acts chapter 8 and 9 when Stephen was stoned, that the people were driven out of Jerusalem. Many of the disciples we read there, they fled out. And many people believe that the believers there in Sidon would have been a direct result of the persecution that took place back in Acts 8 and 9. So the amazing thing here is the fact that the Apostle Paul is now going to a group of people he now calls friends who are in Sidon because he threatened them with their lives. Isn't that amazing how God works sometimes? That's a pretty tangled web, isn't it? "Hey, I'm going to see my friends." "Oh, really? Your friends? Yeah, how did you meet those guys?" "Oh, I was threatening them with their lives and drove them out of town." That's how I usually meet my friends. And now, these group of men, the ones and women that Paul chased from city to city, are now called his friends. Not only that, he's sent there, and really, we get the idea from this text that he's going to have his needs met. He's going there to rest. He's probably going there to be encouraged. He's going there just kind of a time of respite with these other believers, and we need that. We recognize that. So we see that somehow, once again, God is taking an act that would have appeared evil, right, to us and to probably the people at the time, as Saul of Tarsus drove them out, God takes that situation and He uses it for what? For good. It's kind of funny when you read Romans sometimes and you see that God works all things together for what? For good, for those who love God and are called according to His purpose. And you read that and you're going, not now, Lord. Not this. And then we see this tangled web and we see that the fact that God could even use Saul of Tarsus driving out these people to now come alongside Paul and be friends. It's amazing. Last year I was talking to a friend who was a pastor. And he shared with me, he's been a pastor for 27 years. He said, my very first deacon's meeting at the church when I first started, he's been at the same church for 27 years. He said, the first deacon's meeting I ever went to, one of the deacons asked for my resignation. At my first meeting. That's got to be a record of some sort. But the amazing thing is, those two ended up being friends. And God used even that situation to bring these two around, and now it's to the point where they actually call each other friends. That's amazing. Only God can do that. As we see God's hand, it's the same way Joseph could declare to his brothers, what? You meant it for evil, but God meant it for what? For good. Well, the trip continues, verse 4. From there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. When we see that term there, that we had shelter, usually using the island itself to kind of shield themselves from the weather, from the wind and the rain. And they sailed through the sea. And you'll see again that term that kind of bolsters what I said earlier about they're along the coast of Cilicia. Place Paul was very familiar with, and Pamphylia, places we've heard of Paul traveling on his missionary journeys. And we landed at Myra and Lycia. We see all of these different places, the geography being laid out here as they're making their way back to Rome. Now the normal route would have been to go around Cyprus, but because of the wind, they had to sail very close to the coastline. And things still seem fairly calm, but in verse 6, everything begins to change. All change starting in verse 6. There, the centurion found an Alexandrian ship. An Alexandrian ship, meaning he found an Egyptian ship. Okay? More than likely, this tells us that if they took an Alexandrian ship, this was a ship filled with wheat, because that was what Egypt was known for. This would have been a ship filled with wheat that would have taken them back to Rome. So not only going to have the prison cargo now, but they're also going to have a ship loaded down with grain. And they're sailing for Italy. When we had sailed slowly for a good many days, and with difficulty, and we'll see that word again used, difficulty, we arrived at Cnidus. Since the wind did not permit us to go further, we sailed under the shelter of Crete. Again, that term, under the shelter of Crete, off of Salome. And with difficulty, sailing past it, we came to the place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lacia. So we have this large transportation ship traveling along. Some say that this ship would have been roughly 180 feet long, 50 feet wide, and 44 feet deep. That would have been roughly the dimensions of the ship that they were sailing on. And they're going along Crete, which is about a 140-mile-long island. And they're meeting these winds, and they're finding it increasingly difficult to sail. And according to Luke, there's much time lost in verse 9. We see that, but we don't know how much time we're talking about. But this could have been weeks upon weeks lost fighting against the weather that they're traveling. Now, there's a direct reference Paul makes. Luke says, when considerable time had been lost and the voyage was now dangerous since the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them. So what he's saying is this fast is referring back to Yom Kippur, which was the fast of atonement, which is, as far as I know, the only Jewish feast where they actually fast. Okay? And this would have took place in late September to early October. Now, here it doesn't mean a lot to us, but if you live in the Mediterranean region, you understand that you do not sail after September into October. Just as our fishermen here know that there are seasons when you go out and you sail and you fish, and there are seasons where what? You bring it back in, unless you lose your life. And the further you go in, the more dangerous it got. Anybody ever gone to the Caribbean before? You ever taken a cruise down to the Caribbean? Only two people. Wow, you guys. Three. Okay, good. Well, you'll find out that during certain seasons, the prices go what? They go down, right? Why do they go down? Hurricane season. Weather's threatening. You know, you want to take a chance. You might save some money. You got to pay ahead, but just know right off the bat that you could be booking a trip during hurricane season. And this is the same thing here. They recognize that this is getting to a point where it's going to get increasingly risky to be out on the open seas. And because of this, this really begins a warning by Paul that becomes a debate. In verse 10, Paul admonishes the men, "Men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be with damage and great loss, not only of cargo and of the ship, but also our lives." Now think about that statement that Paul is making. It's amazing to me, first of all, that Paul is even able to speak here. If you look at the crew that is there, you have the owner of the ship, the pilot of the ship, you have the centurion. So these three leaders of this whole mission are together talking it out, and here you have Paul weighing in on this, who's nothing more than a what? A prisoner. What allowed Paul to be able to speak? Well, Paul, of course, we know if we study the scriptures, Paul had sailed several times. We know that Paul had also been shipwrecked. Three times. 2 Corinthians 11:25 says, "Three times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I was adrift at sea." And Paul says, you know what? I know about these conditions. I know what's going on. Now, Paul makes a statement here in verse 10, and I kind of want you to mark this. He makes a statement in verse 10 that he's going to later contradict in verse 22. And I believe there's a reason for that, and we're going to talk about that. But I believe part of the reason that he contradicts himself is, here in verse 10, he is looking at this situation purely through human experience. He's saying, my experience as a sailor tells me, based on the wind, based on the time of year, based on the things that are going on, that we are going to die, y'all. Sorry, I'm still in VBS mode. Y'all? His human experience tells him we should not be on the water. And because of that, we're going to lose the ship. And he says we're going to lose not your lives. He says what? Our lives. Now that's interesting. Should Paul know better than that? We'll go on and we'll tackle this in verse 22. But Paul is doing this. He knows the sea. He knows the time frame. And he's basing this all on those things. He's basing this on human experience. But this does not help win the argument for Paul. Verses 11 and 12 says, "But the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than by what was being said by Paul. Because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, the majority reached a decision to put out to sea from there. If somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete facing southwest and northwest, and spend a winter there." So the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the owner of the ship, who I'm sure wanted to get their stuff to port on time. "Hey, we can do this. We can get there." And there's Paul going, "Don't do it." Guess who wins the argument? Of course, the other men. Now, there was a reason Paul said this. Where they were coming to, the area that they were at was not safe for wintering, meaning they were exposed to the elements. They were still exposed to the sea. And if they could just go, the men wanted to go 40 miles further past Fair Havens into Phoenix, because Phoenix was actually going to provide more shelter and a place that you could actually stop for the winter. So for my Arizona friends who are here, you'll recognize the fact that people are wanting to go to Phoenix in the winter. That's a different Phoenix, okay? So just keep that in mind. If you just woke up, I'm not talking about Arizona. Stay with me. So Fair Havens really isn't that fair. I'm sure the Chamber of Commerce probably said, hey, what could we call this place where people would want to stay? We'll call it Fair Havens. Fair Havens sounds like a place you'd want to go, doesn't it? But apparently it's not the place to stay, and they want to move on into Phoenix. And that's what's decided to be done. Well, starting in verse 13, we get a little bit of a break in the action here. It says, when a moderate south wind came up, supposing that they had attained their purpose, they weighed anchor and began sailing along Crete, again, close inshore. Basically, what's taking place right now is the majority of the people that said, you know what, Paul, we're right, you're wrong, we're going to go ahead and sail on anyway, are going, neener, neener. They take off, the weather looks good for a moment, nice south wind. You know, you guys know, right? You feel the winds change. You know when the wind's coming from the north. I've learned this in my time here. Where we live on a hill, I know the difference between a north wind and a south wind now. And they feel a south wind. Things get calm. Things get a little nicer. Things look like they are on the up and up. And I'm sure the majority's going, yep, Paul, we're the professionals here. Just leave it to us. Everything's fine. And then you see the first word in verse 14. What is it? But. Every translation, doesn't matter. You all have the same first word in verse 14. But before very long, there rushed down from the land a violent wind called an Arakulo. And that's probably not right. What I'm going to call it, well, it's right, but that's what the sailors called it. I'm going to call it by what it was known as, which is the nor'easter. This was a northeastern wind, and this was a very feared wind, and every sailor dreaded anything of this type coming their way. And we see how quickly things can change on the open seas. This nor'easter was a severe wind. This was a wind that came in from the mainland and would sweep right over the sea. Luke, he actually uses the Greek word typhonikos, which is where the word we get typhoon. So you get the idea here, right? They are in the worst possible conditions of sailing that you could possibly be in. I want you to picture for a moment, if you've seen the movie, A Perfect Storm. I know it's an older one. But A Perfect Storm is a movie based on a true story of the Andrea Gale, a ship that went out, oddly enough, the captain of the ship convinced his crew that they could go out one more time for one more fishing expedition right before it was not safe to go out. Well, it was already not safe. And, of course, if you've seen the movie, if you know the tale, the Andrea Gale went out and the ship sank and lost all of its crew. And this wasn't a small fishing vessel. This was a large one. Okay? Again, knowing the seasons, listening to reason, especially through human experience, they get out, and here comes this typhoon, this great wind, and when the ship was caught in it, verse 15, and could not face the wind, it says, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along. So basically what's being said here is this. There's nothing we could do. We couldn't put up sail. We couldn't sail against it. We just basically sat there like a toy in a bathtub and went whichever direction the wind took us. It's kind of a scary feeling, isn't it? Do you imagine being on the open ocean in a boat, just being blown wherever the water and the wind take you? If any of you here have motion sickness right now, you're probably taking Dramamine just thinking about it, right? So they go on, verse 15, the ship was driven along, running under the shelter of a small island called Quada. Again, we see that term. They're running under the shelter. They're sailing purposefully towards small islands to try to get a break from the weather. It says, we were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. So starting here in verse 16, there are three things that we see the crew of the ship doing in order to try to save the day, in order to try to survive this storm. Three things that go from verses 16 to 17. And the first thing we see here is in verse 16. It says that we cannot get the ship's boat under control. What's the ship's boat? What are they referring to? They're referring to the dinghy that followed after the ship. They're referring to what would have been the lifeboat that the larger ship would drag behind them in case they were to wreck. They would have this boat with them. They'd pull it behind them with a rope. But in this kind of wind and this kind of weather, what would happen to the dinghy? it'd fill up with water and they would lose the ship. So what they do is, first of all, they rush to get control of the dinghy and bring it up into the boat. And I love, again, we see that word in verse 16. It says, "We were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control." Sounds like Luke wasn't just a writer at this time. What else was he doing? This is all hands on deck. Put down the pen and the paper, Luke. We need you. Get this dinghy on board. Right? It's amazing. In a time of emergency, there's really no rank. Everybody gets involved. Everybody puts their hands in. So that's the first thing that we see them do. They bring the dinghy onto the main ship. The other two things we see are found in verse 17. It says, after they had hoisted it up, after they got it up, they used supporting cables and undergirding the ship, and fearing that they might run aground on the shallows of Syrtis, they let down the sea anchor and in this way let themselves be driven along. So in verse 17, the first thing, or second thing we see that they do is they do something called frapping the ship. Again, this is something you're probably not, you're used to, okay? I never knew what frapping the ship was as well, but apparently wooden boats at that time did not have bolts. They didn't have anything like that. Typically they were glued, they were sealed as well as they could be, which is great in calm seas, not so good during a typhoon. So what they would do is they would cinch up ropes underneath the boat in an attempt to try to hold the boat together. Feel better yet? Put down your Dramamine yet? Good. So they frapped the ship. And then the third thing we see that they did is they dropped the sea anchor. That makes sense, right? You want to stop. You're on a boat. What do? Drop anchor. They're hoping that this slows them down enough that they won't be driven further off course and they're going to be driven. It says specifically that they're not wanting to go to the shallows of Syrtis. This would be a group of shallows, of sandbars, and things of that nature right off the coast of Africa. And that was a ship graveyard. That was known to be a place where ships went to die. This is what they're trying to avoid. Verses 18 and 19, this goes on for a day. Can you imagine this? The next day, as we were being violently storm-tossed, they began to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. What are they doing here? This situation is so dire, it's so hopeless, they're throwing everything off the boat. Now, part of that makes sense. We are fairly certain there's wheat, there's grain on the boat. What happens when wheat and grain gets wet? It swells, right? If I don't want a boat full of wheat in a typhoon. They're throwing everything off the ship that they can possibly. They're trying not to sink. They're trying to preserve their lives. You know, they're probably guys sitting there with buckets, you know, trying to bail out the ship, trying to stay afloat. Things are completely hopeless at this point. So much so that in verse 20 it says, "Since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and no small storm was assailing us, from then on, all hope for all hope for being saved was gradually abandoned." And why does Luke tell us that there were no sun and no stars for many days? You think that's by accident that he says that? What did they use to navigate with? Sun and stars. Have you ever been out driving when a bad storm comes on you? Have you ever been out in a vehicle when that's happened before? Where all of a sudden, you got the road in front of you and that's about all you can see on the horizon. Where you pull over because the weather's so bad. This goes on for many, many days. No sun, no stars, nothing there that they can navigate their way by. Paul reminds us this is no small storm assailing us. And all hope for being saved was gradually abandoned. I bet you they didn't have any appetites. But verse 21 tells us they'd gone a long time without food. And Paul stood up in their midst and said, "Men, you have ought to have followed my advice and not to have set sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss." Somehow Paul finds a way to get an "I told you so" in there. Right? But Paul also doesn't leave them there. He actually, again, provides comfort for them. When all seems to be over, and that's what you would think if we stopped right here, this is all over, they're all going to die, just like Paul said back in verse 10. He says, verse 22, And this is where we see that we for the first time, we get a ray of sunshine and everything is going to be all right. It says, yet, now I urge you to keep up your courage. Now, that actually supposes or presupposes the fact that these men had courage at this point at all. But Paul says, keep up your courage, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. What has happened here? What has changed in Paul's life from verse 10 now to verse 22, where he went from saying, we're going to lose our lives and the ship, to now saying, there will be no loss of life and only the ship will be lost? What changed? This is one of those but God moments where God intervenes with Paul and reminds Paul of his promise. And Paul tells him, verse 23, for this very night, an angel of God to whom I belong. I love that, by the way, that statement right there. Isn't that great as a Christian to say that, that you are God's property? I know this by the God to whom I belong. I read that and I couldn't help. I got a lot of kids, so bear with me, but Toy Story, right? Woody has the little boy's name who owns him. Right there on his boot, it says Andy. You know, and he takes pride in that. I'm owned by Andy. And here Paul is, God owns me. I'm the one I belong to. And when you think about that as Christians, we're the same way. We might not have God's name written on us, but we are covered by the blood of Jesus Christ and His righteousness. We are the property. We've been bought by a price. And nothing like perishable gold, but by the very righteousness and blood of Jesus Christ. He says, the God who owns me sent an angel and he stood beside me and he said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all the lives of all of those who are with you. This had to be comforting for them at this moment to hear that statement. In the midst of the mayhem, in the midst of the storm, in the midst of everything that's going on, Paul says, hold on, this angel of the Lord told me everything is going to be okay. Now, should Paul have known that already? Yeah. Why? Look back to Acts 23:11 if you need to be reminded. Paul in prison, after testifying once again, after being in a riot once again, the very Lord Jesus Christ comes to him in his prison cell, stands behind him and says, you must be my witness in Rome. Just as you've been my witness in Jerusalem, you will be my witness in Rome. Should he have known that he was going to make it to Rome? I trust in God's promises. And you know what though? I'm not going to beat up on Paul. Because what you see in this is something every single person in this room can identify with. There are times where we know the promise of God, yet we lose sight of that in our human experiences, don't we? Our human experience tells us that X, Y, Z is going to happen, and common sense tells us that we should do this, that, or the other thing. And then we completely forget about the promise of God and what God has told us. And at that time, our human experience overrides the very promise of God that we know in our hearts to be true. Right? I mean, if you've been here and you've been through any kind of storm in life, any difficult times, you know very good and well, there are times you've said, God, where are you in this? I don't believe your promise right now. You say you love me. You say you care for me. You said you would never leave me or forsake me. Where are you in this thing? And we need to be reminded that the promise of God does not alleviate our human experience. It doesn't. And this is where the rubber meets the road. You want application? That's application. When we are going through difficult times in life, and if you are not going through one now, you will go through one at some point. It's the nature of life. Understand the fact that your promise, the promise of God to you as a believer, is not going to somehow be alleviate you from life's experiences. You're still going to deal with pain. You're still going to deal with loss. Despite what every prosperity preacher is preaching right now on Sunday, I'm going to tell you right now, if you read the Bible, if you pay attention to the story of the people of God who were loved by God, they didn't have their best life now. Our hope is not in a best life now. Our hope is in a life beyond this one. Praise God. Because if this is all there is, man, sad. Verses 25 and 26, he says, "Therefore, keep up your courage, men, for I believe God, that it will turn out exactly as I've been told." You know what happened? God had a heart-to-heart with Paul. He reminded him of his promises, and Paul said, "You know what? I've been told exactly what's going to take place." And now his human experience is not driving him. The promise of God is driving him. He says, but, right after the comfort, right? There's another but we must run aground. What's he saying? We're going to crash. Be ready. You know, the oxygen tanks are going to be dropping down from the ceiling soon. Assume the position, you know, on the picture and the placard in front of you, because we're going down. We're going to crash. But the promise is that you'll have life, that you're going to live through the crash. That God's hand is on this. The God that I serve, the God that I belong to, is in control of this whole situation. That's amazing. You know, I wonder today how many of you are going through a storm right now. It may be something that everyone knows about. It may be something that no one knows about. It's easy to see some of the outward things, right? We know about some things, but there's people that come into this place that have storms going on and nobody knows about. And my question is, if you're going through the storm, are you relying upon your human experience, or are you relying upon the promise of God if you're a Christian? Which one of those are you holding on to? As I was looking at this text, it's almost impossible not to think about the disciples in the Gospels who are in the sea. They're sailing with Jesus, right? What happens as they're sailing with Jesus? Jesus is doing what? He's sleeping. Storm comes. "Lord, don't you care that we what? Perish." Have you said that before? Are you honest in your Christian walk? "Lord, don't you care that I'm dying down here? Do you not care that I'm in pain down here?" And Jesus stands up. Does he rebuke the disciples? Who does he rebuke? He rebukes the wind and the waves. Now, it would be very easy, and probably us, if we were in that role, right, in our humanness, we'd stand up and rebuke the disciples. "What do you mean, do I love you? Of course I love you. Look at all the things I've done for you. I care for you." But Jesus doesn't rebuke the disciples for their statement. He rebukes the wind and the waves. And even though you question, even though you wonder where God is in that storm, I can tell you today, He wants to remind you of His promise. And He does care. We're told in the book of Hebrews that we do not have a high priest who has not been tempted and gone through everything that we've gone through in this life, and He has come out on the other side without what? Without sin. Jesus coming into this world, taking on flesh, knows every single thing that we experience and go through. He's dealt with loss. He's dealt with pain. He's dealt with separation. All of those things. And I would just encourage you today to be reminded of the promise of God over the experience that you're facing today, whatever that may be, or whatever experience you may be facing in the future. Let's pray.